is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network.
I'm Tom Rowe in Akron. You've tuned into the WGXC Morning Show, and we have a busy show for you today. WGXC's Kimberly Irwin speaks with Oscar Carter, the publisher of The Hudson Connection. And we hear from Lee Flood Smith, the African American Archive of Columbia County, and Dr. Naheem Billups, the founder of Family Benevolent Services in Troy. They both speak with the Reverend Kim Singletary from WGXC on the WGXC Morning Show. Plus, we'll hear the national headlines from the Public News Service and the local Better Weather from the Catskill Maker Syndicate. It all starts after the local news, which is next after Jason Martin from Troy finishes this song on the WGXC Morning Show. Stay tuned.
Connection and the moon turns to blood. A stream runs through. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
There is an open Irish music session on the first Friday of each month at the American Legion Hall, 92 2nd Street in Athens. Anyone is invited to bring a musical instrument or be part of the audience. You can also bring your own refreshments to the Irish open session on the first Friday of every month at the American Legion Hall in Athens. Find out about more events like this on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org, where you can add your own events too if you're helping to put on a community show.
Wave Farm respectfully and humbly acknowledges the past, present, and future Indigenous peoples on whose ancestral lands Wave Farm and WGXC operate and broadcast. The Mohicans name themselves the people of the waters that are never still, following their arrival along the Great Ebb Tide River, also known as the Hudson. The Mohicans stewarded this land over many generations and in dynamic communication and interaction with diverse Indigenous peoples, including the Haudenosaunee Mohawk and the Munsee Lenape. Mohican descendants today live in communities in Ontario, Wisconsin, and Oklahoma. For more information on Mohican history and the contemporary community of the Stockbridge-Munsee Band of Mohican Indians, please visit mohican.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Jane Scarpolino of New Haven, Connecticut. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC Daily News for Wednesday, June 21st. Go to the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Robert Harding reports in the Auburn Citizen that the New York Air National Guard began June 19th helping with the search for the missing submersible carrying five disaster tourists missing since Sunday during a dive to view the wreckage of the Titanic. New York taxpayers are sending an HC-130J Combat King search and rescue aircraft to the scene to help with the search of the submersible. Governor Kathy Hochul said, quote, "The women and men of New York's Air National Guard are always ready to lend a helping hand. I commend the members of the 106th Rescue Wing for their efforts to assist the U.S. Coast Guard in this search and rescue operation," unquote. 13 airmen, including pararescue jumpers, are on the plane, which uses infrared radar to search the Atlantic Ocean for the submersible. Read more about this story in the Auburn Citizen. News 10 in Albany reports that 100 people turned out to protest at Samaritan Hospital in Troy, which is expected to close its maternity unit Burdett Birth Center within 6 months. That eliminates the only birthing facility in Rensselaer County. In 2019, Columbia Memorial Hospital in Hudson ended birthing services at the only birthing facility in Columbia County. Greene County also does not have a birthing facility. Shelley Hagen, who leads the local Planned Parenthood chapter, said at the protest, quote, "It is shameful that access to high-quality maternal care is being cut off here in Rensselaer County," unquote. Jessica Schaefer, an emergency room nurse at Samaritan Hospital, complained that inevitably there will be births in the emergency room now, saying, quote, "You know, in the emergency room, we deal with emergency situations. We deal with a lot of different things. And to put that in the emergency room and to put that stress on the doctors and the nurses who do so much for the community already is ridiculous," unquote. There have been reproductive and birthing services at the Samaritan Hospital's Burdett Birth Center since 2011, when it was formed out of a merger between the maternity units of Samaritan Hospital and St. Mary's Seton Health. So the shrinking of birthing services locally has been going on for years. Read more about this story at News 10 in Albany. Patrick Tyne reports for the Times Union that Stuart Hunt, who had served with the Ancrum Volunteer Fire Company for 21 years, died while responding to a call on June 20th. 37-year-old Hunt suffered a medical event, according to the story, at the scene of a motor vehicle emergency in Ancrum. Hunt also worked for the Columbia County Highway Department as a motor equipment operator. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Representative Elise Stefanik, a Republican who represents Rensselaer County and the rest of the 21st Congressional District, released a statement June 20th after the Justice Department charged Hunter Biden, President Joe Biden's son, with federal tax and weapons offenses. Stefanik said, quote, "This is the epitome of the politicization and weaponization of Joe Biden's Department of Justice as they give a slap on the wrist to President Biden's son, a tax fraud and corrupt pay-to-play criminal. It's never been more clear that we have a two-tiered system of justice," unquote. The other Republican, Mark Molinaro, locally, did not release a statement about Biden, but continued to clamor for the censure of Democrat California Representative Adam Schiff, though Molinaro has not said why exactly Schiff deserves censure. Read more about these stories in the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Wednesday, June 21st. Local early morning temperatures range from 51 degrees in Tannersville to 60 in Red Hook. Regional average soil temperature is 63 degrees. Pollen levels for today will be medium. Today will be dry and warm with a high of 78 at 4 p.m. Overnight drops to 54 degrees. Tomorrow we'll have chances of rain all day with a high of 71. Overnight, temperatures fall to 60 degrees. Friday will be similar with a high of 77 and rain chances all day. Overnight temperatures fall to 66 degrees. Saturday is still looking wet with a high of 81. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 5:43 a.m., low tide at 12:40 p.m., and high tide once again at 6:37 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 71 degrees and the tide strength will be average. Sunset today will be at 8:20 p.m., sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:16 a.m. Looking way up, we see plasma winds will be average at 445 kilometers per second with an average density of 9 protons per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently terrible till dark with fair conditions only below 8 megahertz overnight. There are no chances of aurora tonight. The current sunspot number is 155, and this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
Now, from Survive All comes an economical do-it-yourself fallout shelter.
Civil defense approved and easy to assemble. Takes just a weekend.
Get maximum protection from nuclear fallout for your family.
See a Survive All shelter today.
Ready.
That was Patrick Andy from his 2022 album Living in Mount Zion. That was Got to Give Some Help Dub on 90.7 FM.
Next, Reverend Kim Singletary speaks with Lee Flood Smith from the African American Archive of Columbia County about their Juneteenth efforts.
We are going to present Lisa Flood Smith. Woohoo! So glad to have you here, Lisa. Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Reverend Kim.
So, you know, I saw you or met you first at Alight Forms about a year ago when they were doing a Black History Juneteenth event, and you presented there, and we just knew that we wanted to have you come back into the community again. Your family is from this community, so you're no stranger to us. But talk to us and let's talk about how you got involved in this work that you're doing, what you've done in this work that you're doing, what you uncovered, you've discovered, and now have the blessed opportunity to reveal to all of us who are not in the know.
Oh, that's very big. How long do we have?
Do what you can.
So I got started in this. I mean, you know, we've always, like everybody, we have our little family stories, and we never really knew if any of it, you know, is it true, is it not true, where'd it come from. So my husband is a hobby genealogist, and he did a family tree for us. And the more he found, the more excited I got, because it was like every other day there was a new ancestor, a new somebody. And he has us back now to like the mid-1700s in Columbia County on my mother's side, and about the same date on my father's side. My dad's all from, his family's all from like North and South Carolina. So we have that side. And I'm a big history nerd. I love history. So when he started finding this stuff out, I started going, well, so how did these people live? Where did they live? What was it like? And, you know, things just kind of came together. And the more we talked about it, I talked about it with my mom, and we were like, you know what? It's not just our family. It's not. There are a lot of us there. We need to collect this information and put it together and make sure that it's preserved and people have access to it. So that's kind of where we came up with the idea of founding the African American Archive of Columbia County. And that's our goal right there, is to like, you know, find out as much information, do all the research, help other families with genealogy, and then educate. That's us.
Well, you know, one of the persons that was present with us yesterday, and I'm talking as if people know where we were, what we're doing. So let me just back that up. So for those of you who don't know, I work along with other clergy, ministers, lay people in the community, Columbia County, to take the message of God's love to different areas in the county. And we do it in various ways. And so for Juneteenth, we said, we want to go to the colored people's burial site in Kinderhook. It was historic in that the 8th president of the United States was from Kinderhook. And also, it's one of the few places in the country that I'm aware of that has a site that has been restored. You know, tombstones have been restored, and the area is being maintained, and there's a marker there. And it's a place where we can make connection with our ancestors that were here, whose shoulders we all stand on. This happened at the Rothermel Park on Rothermel Lane in Kinderhook on yesterday. And so one of the persons who grew up in the area who was in attendance, and he was there from the beginning to the end. He even helped us pack up. So I got to give a shout out to Bob Gibson, our BSS commissioner. And he talked about how when he was a kid, he used to play in that park, and, you know, a ball would roll over into those, you know, overgrown shrubs and weeds and things. And they would wonder, who would bury people over here? Why is there a cemetery? But they never thought about it because they didn't have any information about actually who was there. And so the work that you do, and you gave us some background also, I'd like you to talk about the people who did the work of restoring that area and give their names and a little bit about that as well, because they've done a wonderful job. I know their names, but I'm going to let you do it. And because you did it so well yesterday as well. And two of those persons was present with us yesterday as well. So we certainly commend them. So tell us about, you know, the burial site in Kinderhook and how that all came into being. I think it was rededicated in 2017.
Yes.
And you also have some direct connections to that lot as well.
I sure do. So it's a little plot of land. It's about a quarter of an acre, and it was deeded to the Dutch Reformed Church in 1815. It was left in the gentleman who owned the property. It was he left it to them in his will, and it was that one piece of land was to be used for the burial of the colored people of Kinderhook. That's how it's written in his will, for the burial of the colored people of the town of Kinderhook, for that use and for none other. And so it was. It was used that way.
Let me just say, so I don't want people to miss that, because he didn't indicate it as a slave cemetery. It was a burial plot for colored people.
Yes.
But that was so amazing and wonderful in the time period in which he did that, you know?
Right. I mean, 1815, to say, you know, this is for the people of color of the town, that's like amazing, because that's not how they referred to us generally back in those days, you know?
Right.
So, yeah. So, it was in use from about 1815 to sometime before 1900. And there are estimates that there may be up to 500, maybe even a few more than 500 people in that little quarter of an acre. In some cases, there are coffins stacked upon coffins. So there's a lot of our ancestors there. There really are. And it kind of got forgotten and overgrown and was just like a little wooded thing, which is probably why Bob, when he was playing out there, you know, the ball would roll over and no one knew what was there. But back in the 70s, there was a Boy Scout troop that cleared up the land and, you know, cleared out all the weeds and brush and everything. And then the village started to maintain it. So they do keep it mowed and clean. And then most importantly, there was a group of three people. It was Warren Applegate, Hollis Seaman, and Kathy Long. And the three of them, all local people, thought, you know what, this needs to be cleaned and maintained and recognized and honored. So they set about doing that. They had the headstones restored. The headstones had already been moved to like a spot in the middle of the lot, so they're not where the people are buried. And then they worked with the town historian, who unfortunately has already passed away, but Ruth Piwanka actually did the paperwork to have it put on the National Historic Registry and the State Historic Registry. So it will never, never be overgrown and messed with again. It's going to remain as, you know, a sacred ground.
It truly is sacred ground. And, you know, you just can't... you can't get over the sense of, I think, awe and reverence there, you know. And this is my second time there. There are a lot of people in the area who, like myself, did not know of its existence. And so let's talk a little bit about your family connection. That's for me too. You know, how you meet a guy. He's a hobby genealogist. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You know, he starts doing the research on your family. You're a history buff yourself. I mean, you know, this is God all in the mix. You know what I'm saying? And then Absolutely. You find out. What did you find out?
Oh, my gosh. Well, so, you know, there's like two other cemeteries in the area. And I know, you know, I have people in both of them, but not a ton of people. And when we first saw the headstones at the People of Color Cemetery, I looked at the names, and I'm like, oh, wait, I know that name. Springsteen, I know that name. Collins, I know that name. I've seen those names in my family tree. So we did, you know, again, more and more research, and we found out that so the headstones that are there are mostly of children, the ones that remain, because a lot of them just disappeared over the years. So the 15 that remain are mostly of children. And when I looked at the names of those children, three of them were the children of Peter and Harriet Birgit. And I said, wait a sec, Peter Birgit, that's my third great grandfather.
Mm.
And you know, I knew that there were Springsteens there, like I said, and there are Springsteens in my family tree. So the first time I even went there to see those names and to think, this is where my ancestry is. This is where my people are, mm-hmm. you know, they're all here in this little plot of land. So it's amazing and touching and moving. For me, just talking about it, you know, I get a little choked up, because it really makes me feel so rooted in the area, you know?
That was an excerpt of an interview with the WGXC's Reverend Kim Singletary speaking with Lee Flood Smith from the African American Archive of Columbia County. You can hear the entire interview in the WGXC archive. Search for June 20th WGXC Afternoon Show.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
For 50 years, there have been despicable and violent attacks on life, many of the worst happening in the last year alone. Yet we are steadfast in standing up and providing a voice for the voiceless and the most vulnerable, the unborn who cannot speak for themselves.
New York Republican Representative Elise Stefanik looked back over the last year since the U.S. Supreme Court struck down abortion rights across the nation. Since then, 20 states have implemented a range of abortion bans, while in others, courts blocked them pending further litigation. Abortion remains legal in 24 states, some of which enacted new protections. In 2024, Maryland and New York voters will vote on amendments to enshrine reproductive rights in their state constitutions. First Lady Jill Biden says consequences go far beyond a woman's right to choose.
Women are being denied access to medications that treat arthritis and cancer, even when they aren't pregnant. And survivors of rape and incest are being forced to travel across state lines for care.
Meanwhile, youth activists are calling on elected officials in Washington to enact better gun reforms. Education Week's school shooting tracker shows there have been 167 school shootings between 2018 and June 2023. Alea Eastman, a survivor of the school shooting in Parkland, Florida, feels schools shouldn't be war zones.
We can and we must do more to ensure that no one has the fear of joining this club nobody wants to be a part of. I call on those who serve at the will of the people to stand up and join our fight so we can pass sensible solutions. And if not, get out of our way.
Florida Governor and Republican presidential candidate Ron DeSantis visited Nevada for a fundraising event in Gardnerville, where progressives say his policies are a step in the wrong direction. Dawn Echeverry, Nevada State Education Association president, cited Florida's education policies as a sweeping set of restrictions on classroom discussions on race and gender.
When DeSantis calls his effort the parental rights bill, let's just call it what it is, the Don't Say Gay bill. This law is about hate and nothing more. All this bill tends to do is target our LGBTQ+ students, who are some of the most vulnerable in our communities and in our schools.
An Arkansas federal judge has struck down the state's law forbidding gender transition treatments for children and teenagers. The case was viewed as a test of whether transition care bans for minors would withstand legal challenges. In this first-in-the-nation ruling, Judge James Moody Jr. said the law discriminated against transgender people and violated the constitutional rights of doctors. He added the state failed to prove several claims, like transition care was experimental or carelessly prescribed to teens. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. We recently reported on SB 747, a sweeping North Carolina voter suppression bill, apparently ghostwritten by a group with ties to the attempted overturning of the 2020 presidential election. Another bill just filed would strip election power from the governor and election director and give it to the legislature, and fundamentally change how the North Carolina State Board of Elections is chosen. WRAL reports that the governor currently appoints the five-person bipartisan board with a maximum of three from one party. SB 749 changes that to an equal board with four members of each party appointed by the legislature, not the governor. Problem is, a deadlock could mean that either party could derail critical election decisions, such as approving early voting locations or interpretation of rules. If the choice of the board's chair deadlocks, the bill empowers the Republican-dominated legislature to make the appointment. The changes also apply to county boards of elections, to which the legislature appoints two members of each party. Again, if the chair is not chosen, the legislature makes the appointment instead. In addition to stripping power from the governor, the bill also limits the current power of the board's executive elections director, tasked with running the state's elections and making executive decisions to help people vote in emergencies, such as pandemics and hurricanes. We have articles and the text of the bill at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Would you like to do a show on WGXC?
Would you like to do a show on WGXC?
Interesting, boring, really, 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 really boring.
It would be about wonderful things. It would be about
chocolate pigs.
She's obsessed with pigs.
Chocolate pigs?
Awesome.
All the way down.
The only dogs can hear. Did you hear that?
No.
Next, WGXC's Kimberly Irwin speaks with Oscar Carter, publisher of The Hudson Connection.
Born in Yonkers, New York, and I left Yonkers, New York, second grade, I think, third grade, and came to Hudson, where we're having this. My mother and father came up there. There was a school for delinquent girls there, the training school, a New York State training school, and that's what brought them to Hudson. And so I did my whole primary and secondary education there. Graduated from a school called Accomack Central School, which is really outside of Hudson. Left there, went to a school in Virginia. Sorry about that. Went to a school in Virginia. That's my oldest daughter texted me, "Dad, I'm on." she's in D.C. So I left graduating high school, 1968. We'll tell you my age. I'm 76 years old, and I'm not saying that. And went to Virginia State University, which was Virginia State College back then. Turns out my mother and father also went there. They went to Virginia State College. And I think what's significant, I'll mention about that in terms of my family, my mother and father met in college, and Tim mentioned them being both veterans. Somewhere midway or quarterway through their education in college, they decided to enlist in the military. My mother enlisted in the WAC. This is during World War II. Enlisted in the WAC and military Women's Army Corps, and my father enlisted in the Army, and both of them served. Just recently, last month, Hudson, what is that? At the Alumni Association, what's the name of it? The local Veterans Association recognized them, and their pictures are up at the foot of Warren Street in Hudson. We're really proud of that. Since graduation, I am a Vietnam veteran. I served a year over there running a MASH unit in Vietnam, a medical unit. Came back to the States and got my master's degree in hospital administration and ran a few jobs throughout the country, ran a couple hospitals, ran a hospital in Newport News, Virginia. And I'm going to say that was a black hospital. And I define as a black hospital that at one time there were 200 and some black hospitals across the country because of segregation. There are probably maybe two or three now. I haven't stayed kept track, but there's not that many left. Howard University, many consider that a black hospital. I don't particularly consider it a black hospital because it's partly government funded and run. But these other hospitals all had dominant black board. The board of trustees or board of directors were African Americans or blacks. So I ran in one of those hospitals. Let's see. In terms of my career, I don't want to spend a lot of time on that because I don't think it's all that relevant. I'll go back to my upbringing in a minute around the race question, I guess. But I did, when I graduated from college, ran a couple hospitals and did a career of almost 35 years. My last job was, I was the regional director for the New York State Health Department here in New York City, and did that for about 2 or 3 years. Then I ran built a new nursing home for the state of New York in Montrose, New York. So that's kind of my background. I mean, there's a lot I could fill in there. I don't think it's all that relevant in terms of what we want to talk about, but we can come back to it, of course. Let me say this about race. So Kim knows this, and she knows part of it. So I have this whole out of the box, and I'm calling it, I know it's out of the box because nobody's lining up behind me, but out of this out of the box thinking and thought, and this is, you know, my thinking, my personal thought, and there's others that others have this thinking, I know. And that is that I question for moving forward, you know, this idea of race. Now, we all know that it's socially constructed. I got it. It's socially constructed. And therefore, people kind of say, you know, they got the fact that it's that biological. But no, it's socially constructed. And therefore, it exists and we got to deal with it. Well, yes, we do, but not in that context, I don't think. We have to deal with, you mentioned, I think, one humanity or one person. I think we all deal with it in that way. And I think one of the biggest problems in the world is division, this divisiveness that we have in the world. And it's not just race, quote unquote race. It's not just race. It's not just color. It's not just religion. I mean, it's everything. You know, it's the Republicans and the Democrats and the libertarians and the whoever, the independents. And, you know, it's all this division. And what happens is a couple of things happen there. We get boxed into these divisions. I'm a Democrat, therefore I got to do X, Y, Z. I'm a Republican, therefore I got to do X, Y, Z. No, I'm a human being, and I will do X, Y, Z what I feel is appropriate for me and my family and my neighbors and the world as I see fit. And I don't want anybody dictating me in it. So I don't align politically with anybody or any particular one thing. So I hope that's clear. We can come back if not. Let's see. What else? What else, Kim?
Well, I have a question.
Yeah, please.
Because I always sit back and listen, and then I try to figure out what questions my listeners might want to know. But oftentimes, I just couch it like that. I'm sure it's just me.
Yeah. No, that's fine.
But here's a question, and it's a very small one. You mentioned the hospital that you helped build and everything, and you mentioned some of them were built for African Americans to use because of the fact that
segregation.
I understand, like, from my father being born in Florida, there were a lot of native populations there. So when you think of, you know, African Americans or African hospital built for African Americans, were there any other ethnic differences there? Like, were there any Hispanic people or any Chinese people, anyone from any other place, or was it just for African Americans? I'm always wondering, where would the other groups go then?
Yeah, well, hold on. So there was segregation, and we were forced to create black hospitals because of segregation. And when I say, so we were forced to do that, when I say we, the African American community, built these hospitals, and I guess you can say it was for them, but it wasn't. We had white and black patients, so it wasn't just for them, but mostly, and the community that we served was in a predominantly black community. But, you know, we had white patients that come to our hospital on occasion. So, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't segregated. You know, it's the same kind of thing with the historical black colleges.
Right.
I mean, they came out of segregation also, but then they don't discriminate. You know, these black colleges are not just for black folks or African Americans, right. And there's a mix. There actually, you mentioned in Florida, there was, and it's growing now, at Florida A&M, I think Florida A&M had a black hospital on campus. I think that was one of the ones down there a long time ago.
Okay. And one other thing about your background being in with hospitals, and I'm not sure if this is a question that you can professionally answer, but maybe on a personal note. because you do have daughters. I'm part of this African-American woman study of health, and it's now going into it's going to show my age now, 35th year that I've been a member of it. And a lot of research in Boston University is one of the sponsors of this. And it was always interesting because if there were Black hospitals for Black patients, why wasn't there more studies done for Black patients? There was this movie about one woman whose genes they used to help people. If we had, as a community, enough resources, financial resources to put into that, why not some other areas? You know, and especially being a Vietnam vet, or a veteran in general, we had a lot of stories about the Tuskegee experiments, right, where they would take servicemen and do different things to find out how things work in a person's body. So what are your thoughts or answers for something like that? Because you were part of the...
You're asking me why there wasn't more research.
Yes. Was there research hospitals, I guess? Was that not...
There are research hospitals. None of them were Black per
se. That's what I meant. Yeah.
I suspect, and I don't know the answer to this question, I suspect at Howard University Hospital, being a big university hospital and a big university there was some research there, but I don't know, you know, specifically what type of research they did. But I mean, overall, the reason why they didn't do it, because of segregation, because of racism and all of it. You know, it's just something they didn't study, you know, in terms of...
Well, I would imagine you said the board members had majority Black boards. So.
Oh, yes, it did. Yes, it did. Yeah.
But I would imagine the funding would still come from corporate America in that way?
Or... we had primarily at our hospital Medicaid and Medicare, which was governmental, because most of our patients were low income. We had a few private patients that paid directly, but that was very few. But most were Medicare and Medicaid.
That was WGXC's Kimberly Irwin on her June edition of her Race Talk show, speaking with Oscar Carter, the publisher of The Hudson Connection. You can hear the full interview in the WGXC archives online. Search for Race Talks and Oscar Carter. Wave Farms Art Park is now open on Saturdays. Drop in for unannounced guided tours on Saturdays from noon to 6 p.m. or book a tour in advance on other days. Wave Farms' 29-acre campus in Acre is the home of the Art Park with 13 installations in the Study Center, WGXC Acre Studio, and the Wave Farms International Artist Residency Program. Visitors on Saturdays receive a guided tour of the campus. Admission is free and tours typically last 60 to 90 minutes. Again, on Saturdays, Wave Farms Art Park is open for drop-in visits anytime from noon to 6 p.m. from June through October. Stop by Wave Farm on Saturdays from noon to 6 p.m.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Nancy Kern reports for Columbia Green Media that the Green County Industrial Development Agency Executive Director April Ernst said last week that the town of Athens has agreed to a tax break for the Athens Generating Plant. The town was the last remaining entity needed to sign on to the deal after previous approvals by Catskill Central School District and Green County. The Athens Generating Plant is not a new company lured to the area by the tax break. The power plant has been in Green County for 2 decades and is not going anywhere. Still, Green County is giving them a discount on their taxes. The story does not say how much less in taxes Athens Generating Plant will pay because of the tax break. While almost all public comments in this matter have been against the tax break, in the Green County legislature, only Republican Ed Bloomer from Athens voted against it, and he said, and I quote, "I voted against it on the county level, not because I didn't believe in it, but because I went with the full will of my constituents," end quote. At the Catskill Central School District Board of Education, only Brittany Williams did not vote for the tax break, abstaining instead. At the public hearings, taxpayers wondered why this company should get tax breaks when others do not, and complained about the plant's contributions to global warming and bad environmental effects. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Andrea Mako reports for Porcupine Soup that Catskill schools are paying for two superintendents but only getting work out of one. Former Catskill Superintendent of Schools Melissa Barrow is now on the payroll through next June as part of a settlement and separation deal with the district, even though she resigned from the position effective May 17th after only serving since February 12th. Porcupine Soup learned from a Freedom of Information Law request that Barrow will continue to be paid, and I quote, at the contractual rate of $171,000 prorated for the remainder of the 2022-23 school year and at the 2023-24 contractual rate of $172,710 for the 2023-24 school year, end quote. Barrow also gets to keep her health insurance coverage with 87% of the premium paid by the district through December 31st, 2024, unless she obtains, and I quote, comparable health insurance in coverage and cost, end quote, from another employer prior to that date. What do the Catskill School get? Barrow will not file any claims, charges, grievances, or lawsuits against the district, Board of Education, agents, or employees, according to the agreement. The settlement was approved May 17th, but it is unclear when exactly Barrow stopped working for the school district. Dr. Dan Wilson, Catskill's assistant superintendent for pupil personnel, was appointed as interim superintendent of schools for the remainder of the school year. Read more about this story at Porcupine Soup. Jamal Cutler reports in Columbia Green Media that Claverick Democrats have nominated Sheila Graham and Tracy Hennage as the party's candidates for town board in this fall's election. And Chris Liberati Conant of the Village of Chatham was endorsed for Columbia County District Attorney during the Claverick Democratic Caucus. Hennage is an associate attorney with the New York State Department of Health and has volunteered as a foster mom for Pepper Tree Rescue, a dog rescue group. Hennage said, and I quote, I'm fair. I believe in transparency and accountability. Most of all, I believe in listening to one's constituents, ensuring that they are heard. It's fundamental for elected representatives to be engaged with their community, end quote. Graham co-founded Rolling Grocer 19 and was appointed to the Hudson Tourism Board and elected to the Hudson City School District Board of Education. She is also a volunteer programmer on WGXE. Graham said, and I quote, I believe representation matters. Having a diverse town board with varied skills and passions will enrich Claverick by fostering innovation and creativity, end quote. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. And that wraps up the WGXE News Update. You can visit our website at WGXE.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXE sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXE Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow. And now, here is your WGXE weather update. Your forecast for the next 2 days. Well, on Wednesday, partly sunny with a temperature high near 77 degrees. On Wednesday night, partly cloudy with a temperature low of around 54 degrees. And on Thursday, a slight chance of showers after 2 p.m., otherwise, it will be partly sunny with a temperature high near 77 degrees. And on Thursday night, a chance of showers mainly after 8 p.m. It will be mostly cloudy with a temperature low of around 60 degrees. And that is your weather update from WGXE, 90.7 FM, radio for open ears in Greene and Columbia counties.
Next, we hear from Dr. Naheem Billups, the founder of the Family Benevolent Services of Troy, New York, speaking with WGXE's Reverend Kim Singletary. And Billups explains who he is first.
Next guest at the table is no stranger to the community because I've had him here. I've had him on the
show. I've had him here at any of our Gabilonia County outreach events. And this is another dynamic man in his own right. He's a Black African-American, and I say that. Some people say, well, there's no races, it's a human race. No, there's just right, one human race. But in that human race, there are different tribes and different clans, and he's part of my tribe. and I'm so glad to be able to bring him to the table today. Reverend, Doctor, Pastor, New York State Chaplain, Entrepreneur, Father, Husband, Grandfather, and he looks 25. our brother Pastor Naheem Billups. How you doing today, brother?
How you doing today, sister? Can you hear me?
We hear you well. Yes, we do. So, I was so looking forward to having you on today. I was in your area. You're in Troy, New York. And my son actually called me from your new location. We'll get there in a minute. I just want to set a tone. But he called me and he said, they're giving out free ice cream. Do you want some? And I said, who? And he said, your friend, the guy that comes to the outreaches, that has that program. They're doing this. So I said, and I went on over. I saw what you were doing, so I knew I wanted to, you know, catch up with you anyway, but I knew I wanted to have you on the line. Not going to ask you to give a testimony. I want to hold that for the next time you come to town. I want people to come and see you and hear you in person. Okay, so we're going to skip over all the how you got to here, you know, which is amazing in its own right. But I want you to talk a little bit about, you know, it's Father's Day week. All right. So can you just talk a little bit about your fatherhood experience and grandparenting too? And doing all that. How do you do all that, bro? How do you do all that?
So grandparenting. First of all, you have to excuse me. I don't know if you noticed, but I have braces.
No. Oh yeah, I see them now.
Since the last time you see me, yeah, and these things are killing me. I just recently got them tightened, so I'm probably not going to be able to talk that much or respond as quickly. But so grandfatherhood. Let's see. My grandson is 4 years old, and my youngest is 5. So they go to school together. And every morning at 7 o'clock religiously, my 26-year-old son drops off his 4-year-old. So I'm taking my grandson and my daughter to school. If my daughter doesn't have school, my son still drops off my grandson. Yes, but fatherhood is I don't even have a word for it. You know, I'm very involved.
Yes.
Very involved. Never thought that I would see the day. By the way, my grandson calls me daddy. I don't know if he calls me daddy because my son calls me daddy or because I look young, but his mother tries to make him call me granddad. I'm like, I'm not ready for that yet.
You know what? I'm with you on that one. First of all, the word for parenting, I say it's a life sentence, okay?
Yes. Yes.
Stop at 18. It doesn't stop at 21. It's a life sentence.
Life sentence.
And so
my oldest son ran out of gas on the way dropping off the 4-year-old today. So I had to go take him to the gas station, get gas. Literally, we were literally 2 minutes from the daycare. But he's like, Dad, I'm not going to take him to daycare. They don't know who I am. You take him to school every single day. So I had to get gas, come all the way back to my house, then go all the way to daycare. They expect you to do everything.
Okay. So all of you young people, teenagers who say, I want to have a baby. I want to have a baby. Put on the brakes, girl. Put on the brakes, sir.
Put them on.
Because it's a life sentence. But it's a joy. It's a joy. And it can be
yes,
a joy.
Ma'am.
But life is what we make it, right?
So. Yes, ma'am.
And then the grandparenting thing, too. So, you know, when I go out with my son and his sons, I call them my three sons.
Mm-hmm. How many grandkids do you have?
I have two. I have two, okay. And two and through. They're two and through. So, you know.
Okay. And then I have five. Five and one on the way.
Oh, my. Your quiver is full.
Uh-huh.
So, but it's beautiful. And so, you know, on that note, you started, how long ago did you start Family Benevolent Services?
Family Benevolent Services was incorporated by the state in 2015.
Okay, so relatively new. Yes, relatively new. All right, so tell us about the vision that you had for Family Benevolent Services in the beginning. We're going to come up from the beginning to where you are today.
Okay. In the beginning, the vision that I had for Family Benevolent Services was to, I wanted to help individuals who were placed on palliative care, because I had found out that my father and my mother were both diagnosed probably a year and a half apart with cancer, which quickly progressed, stage four, metastasized. And I just saw that individuals who let's just say this, hospitals force a lot of people into hospice. And a lot of individuals that go to hospice believe that that's their only option. So they don't know that they don't actually have to stay in a facility with strangers and die. They can go home and die. So once I learned what palliative care is, Family Benevolent Services was a community outreach center initially for individuals who had individuals that either had sickle cell, cancer, age, whatever, old age. We provided counseling, and we provided individuals to go into their homes, cook for them, make them comfortable. And then it just wound up going into something different, because when you're in different people's homes, you start to see that there are other issues that may require other services that are not offered by traditional, you know, agencies and bureaucracies. Because when you're in people's homes, you get a chance to see their personal business and see different things that are going on. And, you know, maybe there's a criminal case pending, or a civil case, a child has lead poisoning. And once the matriarch of the family is gone, you know, there's a whole bunch of different issues. So we started to create a bunch of different comprehensive programs that help individuals deal with different areas. Then we wound up growing, wound up getting a home office, and we have about 14 licensed counselors now.
Excellent. So you all provide training through Family Benevolent Services.
Yes. And I have to say this, Family Benevolent Services is ministry based. We started off as a ministry that now has specialized counselors. So I like to call them ministerial counselors, even though they're licensed counselors through the agency. But Jesus is at the base of everything that we do. So essentially, we are a ministry that is operating in the fivefold gifts and doing what we're supposed to do by catering, or should I say, serving the people.
Mm-hmm. And that Matthew 25 model, you know?
Yes.
And that's what's up, you know? Catholic Charities is probably one of the biggest known Protestant welfare agencies, I guess.
Yes.
And then the Jewish organization, is it FAKES? What was that called? I can't think of what the Jewish organization that does fivefold ministry work.
Yes.
So, yeah. And so Family Benevolent Services, just to put it in a little context for people, is you know, now their eighth year in that vein. And
yes.
Growing and growing and growing. And so I like what you said and pointed out about it being ministerially based, because sometimes people who are, I'm going to say, this is on me, but I'm going to say insensitive to the view that believers offer simply because we're believers, and they don't be connected and associated with God and, you know, Jesus, you know, and church and all that stuff. So they forego the gifts, skills, talents, resources, and opportunities that God have put into us to serve our communities, right?
Yes.
And so we sometimes struggle, you know, to get the resources and to get the credentialing and, you know, to get various different things. But God's grace has been upon you, and you're a pioneer in this area in doing what you do and being unapologetic about this is ministerial based.
Right.
And I just think that is just so wonderful. So I know that you all had, I guess it was like a pizza shop and a sandwich shop or something like that for a period of time in Troy. And then next door you also have like your offices and service agency. So tell us about, you know, that experience, what you experienced in setting those two things up. I remember it was a big ribbon cutting a couple of years ago, and you know, so let's talk about that experience.
So one of the things that I see happening on a daily basis that's been happening over the years is the municipalities and the bureaucracies have become modern day Pharisees and Sadducees. You know, they say that they're here to help. They may want to help, but like you said, there's a lot of insensitivity. So when a lot of the government money comes in for these 501c3s, the government has a very big